Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The truth is the most convincing story that maps onto reality, and that's why the central narrative is falling apart.
Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
We must see the central narrative for the fiction that it is. We are Americans.
While elections are sometimes messy, this was a secure election.
The founders began the fight for human liberty and self-governance, and it's up to us to finish the job.
I tell you what, we are in a truth emergency right now.
This is the end game.
It's Friday, April 26th, 2024, the 1192nd day of dystopia. I'm your moderator, Chris Paul. Let's be reasonable. A warm welcome and hello to all of you listening to the podcast on the day of its release. The only way to do that is by becoming a paid subscriber at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as little as $50 a year or $5 a month. And in doing so, you will be supporting me, the work I do, and this show as it expands. And if you can't or you simply don't want to, continue listening to the podcast for free on a wide variety of podcast platforms. And of course, Rumble. All I ask is that you share it with your friends. You can find the links to the podcast, the writing, the social media, and the merch site by visiting linktree.com/I'm Your Moderator. All right, so this week we have talked about the geopolitical battle between the global good twin and the global evil twin, the battle between the forces of centralization versus decentralization, the one world liberal international rules-based order against the countries and the leaders leading this emerging multipolar world order of sovereign nations putting their own countries and their own people's interests before the interests of the global regime. We have tracked for years now the countries around the world that are able to eject the global regime and remove its presence and control in their society. We talked about Niger on Tuesday, and today we'll talk about another African nation following close on their heels. We have talked about the move away from the global regime and its central bankers with their fiat currency currently branded as the U.S. dollar and toward more decentralized systems and decentralized currencies. We discussed the Repo Act and seizure of Russian assets. Russians are now seizing back $300 billion of Western assets. So that's going to be even, I guess. We talked about the toothlessness of Western sanctions The regime is being moved out physically, and it's being moved out and ignored financially. And yesterday we talked about a parallel infrastructure emerging for energy, for currency, for national defense, and of course for communications and this next generation of social media platforms that will be able to get around the current controls. And so we're going to talk about all of those today. And if we get through that, then we'll talk about some more stuff. But let's begin with former Congressman Devin Nunes. While in Congress, he was a member of the Permanent Select Subcommittee on Intelligence, and now he is the CEO of Trump Media and Technology Group, their primary product being Truth Social. This is the DJT stock we are talking about here. This is Devin Nunes speaking to Newsmax.
Yeah, but Congressman, before I let you go, I got to get to one more thing. You're sounding the alarm on possible unlawful trading practices. Tell us why Trump Media and Technology Group is calling on Congress to open an investigation on stock manipulation.
Well, as you know, Chris, we have a bunch of awesome retail shareholders. And in fact, we don't care if the investment banks and investors these big institutions, if they don't want to buy our stock, great. But we have retail shareholders that matter. There's a lot of irregularities here. We notified the NASDAQ. We've been working with the NASDAQ. And also, you know, we asked Congress to get involved here because, look, if they're doing this, a lot of these firms, if they're producing counterfeit shares, I mean, this is a major scandal if it's happening. And in the past, it has happened. And what happens to them? It's a lot like we were talking about in the early segment. They get a slap on the wrist years later after this goes through litigation. So what the Congress really needs to look at here is that, does this fall under the RICO statute? You know, the Biden DOJ, they love the RICO statute now. So guess what? If people within these hedge funds are colluding with each other, that's RICO. That's actually a real RICO, unlike the RICO that they're using today. So Congress needs to look at that, whether or not these firms are evading taxes. This is serious stuff. So we're going to defend our retail shareholders. We're building a great business here. And I'd prefer, quite frankly, to work on building the business, building our streaming platform so that we can have great companies like Newsmax be part of it. But if I have to run another investigation, I will. All of these investment funds, they know my phone number. They know how to get a hold of me. Guess what? They haven't called me yet. The easiest way to clear all this up is just to say, hey, this isn't happening. It's not happening. And guess what? Guess how many have said that? Zero. Zero.
None.
And that tells me,
well, you know,
there might be something.
So Nunes here again, suggesting a criminal conspiracy, coordination to violate the law in order to destroy Donald Trump's company. And the funny thing about this company in particular is that it is a communications company based on the principle of free speech and the ability to give people freedom of speech, a platform for people to connect where free speech is still possible, because it's not possible on the legacy social media platforms. We're getting to the point where people don't even doubt it anymore. They understand that the regime is censoring the political speech of American men and women every day in order to protect the central narrative, however they can, from complete collapse. But it is completely collapsing. That is why they are so desperate to increase their control. And we were given another perfect example of that yesterday. This is from ArsTechnica.com. FCC restores net neutrality rules that ban blocking and throttling in 3-2 vote. So we covered this a couple of weeks ago when FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr, a Trump appointee, wrote a memo warning of the increased government control over our information infrastructure that could be on its way as a result of an FCC vote. Well, that vote took place yesterday. The Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 to impose net neutrality rules, restoring the common carrier regulatory framework enforced during the Obama era and then abandoned while Trump was president. The rules prohibit internet service providers from blocking and throttling lawful content and ban paid prioritization. Cable and telecom companies plan to fight the rules in court, but they lost a similar battle during the Obama era when judges upheld the FCC's ability to regulate ISPs as common carriers under Title II of the Communications Act. Consumers have made clear to us they do not want their broadband provider cutting sweetheart deals with fast lanes for some services and slow lanes for others. FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel said at today's meeting, they do not want their providers engaging in blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization. And if they have problems, they expect the nation's expert authority on communications to be able to respond. Because we put national net neutralities back on the books, we fix that today. ISPs insist the rules aren't necessary because they already follow net neutrality principles, yet also claim the rules are so burdensome that they will be prevented from investing more in their networks. Lobby group U.S. Telecom said today that relentless regulation comes at the cost of, quote, failing to achieve internet for all, end quote. This is a non-issue for broadband consumers who have enjoyed an open internet for decades, U.S. Telecom CEO Jonathan Spalter said. Rather than pushing this harmful regulatory land grab, policymakers should keep their eyes on the real-world prize of building opportunity for everyone in a hyper-connected world. Skipping down. FCC Republicans blasted the Democratic majority today. The internet in America has thrived in the absence of 1930s command and control regulations by the government, Commissioner Brendan Carr said. Carr, who spoke for more than a half an hour, described how the FCC's net neutrality decisions were allegedly swayed by President Obama in 2015 and by President Biden this year. The FCC has never been able to come up with a credible reason or policy rationale for Title II. It is all just shifting sands. And that is because the agency is doing what it's been told to do by the executive branch. Carr also blamed judges for giving the FCC too much power. He expressed hope that the current Supreme Court will ensure that only Congress can decide whether Title II is applied to broadband. Congress never passed a law saying the internet should be heavily regulated like a utility, nor did it pass one giving the FCC the authority to make that determination. The executive branch pressured the agency into claiming a power that remained and remains with the legislative branch, Carr said. And I believe Carr there is referring to Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, a case before the Supreme Court right now. The Supreme Court is expected to overturn the process that's been in place now for 40 years improperly that suggests courts should defer to agencies in their rulemaking capacity, even if the Congress has not explicitly delegated through legislation the responsibility of those agencies to make those rules by which other people have to live and companies have to do business. This allows for one of the major expansions of the administrative state. All of these various executive branch agencies that have these career public officials, nearly all of whom are in their jobs attempting to implement the global regime agenda, they get to decide how people and businesses in this country are allowed to operate, how they're allowed to go about their lives. No one has given them this power. All of this rests on a court precedent, and that precedent is about to go away. It is impossible to hold rulemakers accountable if those rulemakers are unelected and unfireable and a part of the executive branch that remains totally unresponsive to the people. Covering the arguments in Chevron, January 17th, SCOTUS blog wrote, the court's ruling could have ripple effects across the federal government, where agencies frequently use highly trained experts to interpret and implement federal laws. Although the doctrine was relatively non-controversial when it was first introduced in 1984, in recent years, conservatives, including some members of the court, have called for it to be overruled. And this should be a monumental decision. This is one of the things that will allow Donald Trump to tear down the administrative state and actually drain the swamp. It also might make this net neutrality rule fairly short-lived. We should have that decision by the end of June, and I imagine there will be lawsuits filed to challenge the FCC's authority to implement this regulation, and hopefully we will not have to deal with the fallout if it is as Brendan Carr suggests. Regardless, as long as the government is able to control these things, and members of the Uniparty, people who work in service of the global regime, are still in control of these quote-unquote private companies, then they will always be searching for new ways to gain further control and make sure that people are receiving their information, not our information. As we discussed yesterday, the answers to these problems still include technology. And if we have this centralized and centralizing force acting upon us that even when restrained is still doing bad things, then maybe we need to move to that parallel system. The only way that parallel system is built up enough for the experience to be equivalent is for us to participate in these early stages so that it can be tested and strengthened. The goal is to take the control out of their hands in every way that you can. If you don't want to abandon the legacy platforms, fine. That is totally up to you. But you should still familiarize yourself with the next generation of platforms, establish a presence for yourself, know how to find the other people who you follow, so that when you get banned or shadow banned from Instagram or Facebook or YouTube or X,
formerly Twitter,
you won't miss a beat. They are going to attempt all of the things they attempted in 2020, and they will use whatever tools are at their disposal to make sure they can seize back control over the means of information. There are people who have been working on these problems for a long time, and not all of them align with us politically when it comes to Donald Trump. Some of them are total normies about politics, and they think our elections are very free and fair and very safe and secure, and that the reported results accurately reflect the will and intent of the American voter. And they may be completely clueless about who is posing the threat to them that they are trying to counteract. But the point is that they understand the threat and they have thought a lot about how to counteract that. A lot of that stuff is being implemented. And the same thing holds true for many Bitcoin people as well. There are a lot of people in this world who are total political normies and really don't know much about politics. What they know about politics is wrong. Maybe they made terrible decisions during COVID. We are not trying to elect all of these people as president. We're not trying to ask these people to rule over us and make our decisions for us. They could even be people who were explicitly building these tools for the enemy. But as long as we seize the tools, we can still make use of their expertise on how the tools work and how to use them effectively. It might even be the case that we are at our strongest when we are using their tools against them. All right, so let's go to some geopolitics. We talked about U.S. troops being ejected from Niger earlier in the week, and we're going to talk about the same thing happening in Chad in just a minute. But on Truth Social today, an account that goes by Just Kath highlighted a story from a few years back that relates directly to that Niger story. And so this is the New York Times from September 9th, 2018. CIA drone mission curtailed by Obama is expanded in Africa under Trump. And I'm not going to go all the way through this, but a few paragraphs. The CIA is poised to conduct secret drone strikes against Al-Qaeda and Islamic State insurgents from a newly expanded airbase deep in the Sahara, making aggressive use of powers that were scaled back during the Obama administration and restored by President Trump. Late in his presidency, Barack Obama sought to put the military in charge of drone attacks after a backlash arose over a series of highly visible strikes, some of which killed civilians. Skipping down, Mr. Obama had curtailed the CIA's lethal role by limiting its drone flights, notably in Yemen, Some strikes in Pakistan and elsewhere that accidentally killed civilians, stirring outrage among foreign diplomats and military officials, were shielded because of the CIA's secrecy. As part of the shift, the Pentagon was given the unambiguous lead for such operations. The move sought, in part, to end an often awkward charade in which the United States would not concede its responsibility for strikes that were abundantly covered by news organizations and tallied by watchdog groups. However, the CIA program was not fully shut down worldwide, as the agency and its supporters in Congress balked. The drone policy was changed last year after Mike Pompeo, again, this is 2018, after Mike Pompeo, the CIA director at the time, made a forceful case to President Trump that the agency's broader counterterrorism efforts were being needlessly constrained. The Derku base was already up and running by the time Mr. Pompeo stepped down as head of CIA in April to become Mr. Trump's Secretary of State. Skipping down once again. The CIA base is hundreds of miles closer to southwestern Libya, a notorious haven for al-Qaeda and other extremist groups that also operate in the Sahel region of Niger, Chad, Mali, and Algeria. It is also closer to southern Libya than a new $110 million drone base in Agadez, Niger, 350 miles west of Derku, where the Pentagon plans to operate armed Reaper drone missions by early next year. So that would be 2019. That is the base we were discussing the other day. The CIA operation in Derku is burdened by few, if any, of the political sensitivities that the United States military confronts at its locations, said one former American official involved with the project. Even so, security analysts said, it is not clear why the United States needs both military and CIA drone operations in the same general vicinity to combat insurgents in Libya. France also flies Reaper drones from Niamey, but only on unarmed reconnaissance missions. Yet why would you need both the U.S. military and the CIA? Aren't they both controlled by the American president, and aren't they both working to achieve the same goals? It's like in every police movie and television show ever, where the federal agents stop in and then there's some argument about whose jurisdiction this is. It always presents that nice tension between the two different cops who dislike each other and want to each be in control. And only later on, when everything is on the line, do they finally learn to work together and trust one another. Going back a bit further, this is The Intercept from August 21st, 2018. The U.S. is building a drone base in Niger that will cost more than $280 million by 2024. A U.S. drone base in a remote part of West Africa has garnered attention for its $100 million construction price tag. But according to new projections from the Air Force, its initial cost will soon be dwarfed by the price of operating the facility, about $30 million a year. By 2024, when the 10-year agreement for use of the base in Agadez, Niger ends, its construction and operating costs will top $250 million, or around $280 million, to be more precise. And that's actually an undercount. The new projections from the Air Force do not include significant additional costs, such as salaries of the personnel stationed at the base or fuel for the aircraft flying out of Agadez. The facility, which is part of the expanded U.S. military footprint in Africa, is now the largest base-building effort ever undertaken by troops in the history of the U.S. Air Force, according to Richard Komarek, a spokesperson for U.S. Air Forces in Europe and Air Forces Africa. The outpost, officially a new airfield and associated facilities at Nigerian Air Base 201, or AB-201, was billed as a $50 million base dedicated to surveillance drones, and it was to be completed in 2016. Now it's slated to be a $100 million base for armed MQ-9 Reaper drones, which will finally take flight in 2019, though the construction cost is hardly the end of the tab for the facility. The article quotes a planning document from 2015 that says, moving operations to Agadez aligns persistent intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance to current and emerging threats over Niger and Chad, supports French regionalization, and extends range to cover Libya and Nigeria. So we're being told by regime-aligned media sources that this project is very expensive and that we don't need it. It's already taken care of. Trump reversed an Obama policy, which was totally unnecessary. Obama had the right policy in place. This is too expensive and we don't need it. And what Trump pushed was scheduled to expire this year. This is the status of forces agreement we were talking about the other day. All of that was kept in place throughout the fake president's term. And now Donald Trump is coming back. The U.S. troops leave. And whatever Hussein had going on in Niger, whatever the global regime had going on in Niger, seems now to be fully extracted. It is interesting that these U.S. military installations are being built up here in Niger, of course, in Afghanistan, as we saw in 2021. And then they are handed back to the people from that region. We are told we have to be in all these countries around the world in order to protect them from terrorism. But the regime that says that is the same regime that creates and trains and arms and funds the terrorist organizations and the cartels, because those are the private armies of the global regime. They exist to destabilize these societies. From a devolution perspective, this very much seems like a Trump plan put in place in 2018 has progressed over the last 6 years as scheduled, and now U.S. troops are leaving the country, turning things over to the people of Niger as scheduled, as we watch this multipolar world order emerge. This is the sort of thing you would expect to happen, and it's playing out along a timeline on which you would expect this to happen. And so let's jump back onto this timeline. This is the New York Times from yesterday. U.S. to withdraw troops from Chad, dealing another blow to Africa policy. Now, Chad is Niger's neighbor to the east, right smack dab in the heart of Africa, and part of that land bridge we have discussed. The Pentagon will withdraw dozens of special operations forces from Chad in the next few days, the second major blow in a week to American security and counterterrorism policy in a volatile swath of West and Central Africa, U.S. officials said on Thursday. The decision to pull out about 75 Army Special Forces personnel working in N'Djamena, Chad's capital, comes days after the Biden administration said it would withdraw more than 1,000 U.S. military personnel from Niger in the coming months. The Pentagon is being forced to draw down troops in response to the African government's demands to renegotiate the rules and conditions under which U.S. military personnel can operate. Both countries want terms that better favor their interests, analysts say. The decision to withdraw from Niger is final, but U.S. officials said they hope to resume talks on security cooperation after elections in Chad on May 6th. They might as well just announce to the world that they plan on stealing the election in Chad. This is like when some drunk guy gets kicked out of the bar and tries to get back in an hour later with six more of his drunk friends. They are going to meddle in the affairs of another country in order to restore their control over Niger. And I'm not kidding about the election interference, by the way. It is being seeded in mainstream press outlets across the world. Here's just a bit of the coverage. This is Al Jazeera on February 29th, 2024. Why is Chad boiling over ahead of long-awaited elections, and what's next? And let's go through some of this, because we are seeing, again, the same playbook play out, slight variations, slightly different timelines, but all across the world. Heavy gunfire erupted in Chad's capital, N'Djamena, on Wednesday, just hours after announcements of a long-awaited election date in the Central African country. The Chadian government said its security forces pushed back against members of the opposition Socialist Party Without Borders, who led an attack on state security forces early Wednesday after an altercation with a party member. That's quite a name. The party's acronym, they go by PSF. PSF leaders denied those accusations in Facebook posts, but local newspapers reported more gunfire and a possible bombing of the party's headquarters later on Wednesday. Local authorities said Thursday that dozens of people had been wounded or killed. PSF leader Yahya Dillo was among those killed. Internet services in the country remain cut since Wednesday, adding to the uncertainty. Chad has long been in the grip of political tensions arising from shifting allegiances and familial and tribal relations within the political elite. Uncertainty following the death of longtime ruler Idriss Deby in 2021 and the installation of his son Mohammed as leader have escalated the problems. And keep in mind, of course, that this is a regime outlet. Now, this article is quite long. Let's skip down to the end. Is Deby setting the stage for May elections? Troels Birchall Henningsen of the Royal Danish Defense College said that although an insurrection by the PSF is possible, Deby could also be pulling a Deby, having inherited his father's repressive methods, including possibly staging events that make it easier to eliminate political rivals. Chadian politics under Idriss Deby Itno was characterized by disappearances, a possibly faked coup in 2013 to eliminate political rivals, and manipulative practices that guaranteed the victory of the president and his party, Henningsen said. Many opposition parties have publicly denounced the ruling party's decision to name Deby as its candidate for the May elections, even though it was expected. But with fewer critical voices in the way, May could deliver an easy win for Deby at the polls. Truly free and fair elections were never likely, Henningsen said of the coming vote, adding that Deby will likely win resoundingly and offer opposition members juicy government positions. Let's skip forward to March. This is also from Al Jazeera. Chad main opposition figures barred as leaders cleared for election. Authorities in Chad have cleared 10 candidates for this year's long-awaited presidential election, barring two fierce opponents of the military government from standing. Chad's Constitutional Council announced on Sunday that outspoken opposition figures Nasur Ibrahim Ngoy Kursami and Rakis Amat Saleh would be barred. It said their applications had been rejected because they included quote-unquote irregularities. The council said that the nominations of interim president Mohammed Idriss Deby and the country's recently appointed prime minister, Success Masra, had been accepted. The Central African nation is scheduled to hold the first round of a presidential election on May 6th, the second round on June 22nd, with provisional results on July 7th. The elections are part of a transition back to democracy from rule by Chad's military government, which is one of several currently in power in West and Central Africa. There have been 8 coups in the region since 2020, sparking concerns of a democratic backslide. That is Africa, with the backing of Russia and maybe the backing of that sovereign alliance and BRICS nations, removing the regime from Africa. In December, Chadians voted in favor of a new constitution that critics said could help cement Deby's grip on power as it allowed him to run for the presidency. Masra, previously a staunch opponent of Chad's military rulers, had fled the country after dozens were killed when security forces cracked down on demonstrations in the capital, N'Djamena, in October 2022. He returned in November after a reconciliation agreement was signed that guaranteed him the ability to participate in political activities. Wakit Tama, another one of the main opposition platforms in Chad, on Saturday called for a boycott of the presidential vote, denouncing it as a masquerade aimed at upholding a dynastic dictatorship. So we are already hearing common recurring themes that we have dealt with in elections around the world over the past 3 years that we've been paying attention to these things on this podcast. Now let's go to American state media outlet Voice of America. The headline from April 11th, just a couple weeks ago. Chad's opposition says Deby flouting rules by launching presidential campaign early. Opposition candidates are accusing Chad's military ruler, General Mohamed Idriss Deby, of flouting election rules and launching his campaign before the official starting date of April 14th. The transitional president, who seized power after the death of his father in 2021, is attempting to cement his rule with a victory in Chad's presidential election on May 6th. And let's skip down near the end. The 37-year-old Deby was proclaimed head of an army junta after rebels killed his father in 2021 after more than 30 years in power. The presidential election in May is meant to be a transition back to democracy. Deby initially promised an 18-month transition period after he seized power. He later appointed himself as the head of a transitional government. Opposition parties say he uses the military to suppress the opposition. Opposition candidates urged Chadians to be vigilant and report suspected election malpractices to the National Agency for the Management of Elections. They also called for the international community to take note that Deby is not respecting democratic norms by campaigning before the official start date. The nine candidates challenging Deby in the election, including pro-democracy figure Success Masra, who now serves as transitional prime minister, say Deby does not want to lose his family's grip on power. Deby says he will respect the verdict of the ballot and hand over power if he is defeated. So from these regime-aligned outlets, it sounds like Deby is the bad guy. And although he's in power and will very likely remain in power after the elections, it's because he has barred the political opposition. He started campaigning before he was allowed to. He's probably going to break the election rules. So when he is announced the winner, the global community needs to understand that he wasn't really the winner. He's an illegitimate winner. This is what they did to Donald Trump after 2016. It's what we just saw them do to Vladimir Putin in his elections. It should be like second nature to detect the dynamics at play here. We are dealing with Marxists and liars. We are dealing with a propaganda state media. Everything is framed in the victim-oppressor construct, and whatever position they disagree with is immediately identified with the oppressor. Deby is using the military to oppress his opposition. He is cheating in the elections. His father, who led the country, was killed, and he is still said to have seized power. But let's return to the New York Times and the article about troops leaving Chad. The departure of U.S. military advisors in both countries comes as Niger, as well as Mali and Burkina Faso, is turning away from years of cooperation with the United States and forming partnerships with Russia, or at least exploring closer security ties with Moscow. And that is an interesting verbal sleight of hand that the New York Times is using there. They're going to be partners with the bad, bad Russians. Or at least they might work with the Russians a little bit. We are supposed to understand that what is happening is very bad because now what is happening is kind of aligned with Russia. The Kremlin uses persuasion and other times coercion to achieve its aims. And yeah, that's messed up. They should use their military and currency manipulation to achieve their aims like the global regime does. That doesn't constitute persuasion or coercion. That constitutes force. It's so much more moral, apparently. The United States warned Chad's president last year that Russian mercenaries were plotting to kill him and three senior aides, and that Moscow was backing Chadian rebels massing in the Central African Republic to the south. At the same time, the Kremlin was courting sympathizers within Chad's ruling elite, including cabinet ministers and a half-brother of the president. Apparently, United States foreign policy is being dictated by everyone's stalker ex-girlfriend. The impending departure of the U.S. military advisors from Chad, a sprawling desert nation at the crossroads of the continent, was prompted by a letter from the Chadian government this month that the United States saw as threatening to end an important security agreement with Washington. The letter was sent to the American defense attaché and did not directly order the U.S. military to leave Chad, but it did single out a special operations task force that operates from a Chadian military base in the capital and serves as an important hub for coordinating U.S. military training and advising missions in the region. About 75 Green Berets from the 20th Special Forces Group, a National Guard unit from Alabama, serve in the task force. A handful of other U.S. military personnel work in the embassy or in different advisory jobs and are not affected by the decision to withdraw. As talks continue with Chadian officials, U.S. Africa Command is currently planning to reposition some U.S. military forces from Chad, a portion of which was already scheduled to depart, Major Pete Nguyen, a Pentagon spokesman, said on Thursday. This temporary step is part of an ongoing review of our security cooperation, which will resume after the May 6th presidential election, Major Nguyen said. While France, a former colonial power in the region, has a much larger military presence in Chad, the United States has also relied on the country as a trusted security partner. Chad's Presidential Guard is one of the best trained and equipped in the semi-arid belt of Africa known as the Sahel. The country has played host to military exercises conducted by the United States. Officials at the Pentagon's Africa Command say Chad has been a major partner in an effort involving several countries in the Lake Chad Basin to fight Boko Haram. Ah, terrorists, always the justification for us having a military presence everywhere in the world. U.S. Africa Command remains dedicated to building enduring partnerships with Chad and other African nations in the Sahel to address mutual security concerns and help promote a peaceful and prosperous future in the region, General Michael E. Langley, the head of the command, said during a visit to Chad in January, according to a statement from the command. Now, it's weird, isn't it, that our mainstream media never really attempts to give us the bigger picture view. All of these stories just kind of stand on their own. Each situation has its own very specific explanation. They're removing the troops because of this and this and that. And they might come back if this thing or something else occurs. They're there for a good reason. And if they leave, the whole region might deteriorate somehow. But they never explain what's happening in the big picture. And the big picture is clear to see at this point. These aren't major nations like the United States and Canada and Brazil removing the regime. These are tiny countries around the world removing the regime. And yes, they each have backing from much bigger, more powerful nations in those kind of regions of responsibility. But you look at Myanmar, you look at Mali and Burkina Faso, eight African nations since 2020 with quote-unquote coups, which is what they call it, when the sovereign forces of a nation attempt to remove the global regime's infiltration. They call that a military coup. Their people are supposed to remain in power forever. That was the deal they set up. They had that deal in place. They had their people in those positions of power, and neither the people of the country, nor the military, nor anyone are allowed to remove those regime politicians. Doing that, no matter how illegally and illegitimately they are holding power, constitutes a coup. And hopefully it never gets to the point where it matters, but this would be the justification for them sending in forces, UN peacekeeping missions, for instance. But then you have to take that one step further. They haven't been sent in to any of these countries, and it's been years now. Why aren't they doing that? Well, maybe we're just being told fantastical stories by the mainstream media meant to convince virtually no one except me and my audience that this is what is happening around the world. They are obviously peddling the inverted version of that. Maybe it is all just a smokescreen to obscure the fact that all of these factions in all of these small nations who have launched and staged all of these coups, they're also part of that same global regime, and they're going to implement the same global agenda. But outside that very clever, I would have to admit, PSYOP, then we are seeing very clearly that the global regime no longer has the power to maintain its grip on these nations if and when they want to leave. And there's some pretty substantial symbolism behind some of that, too. I mean, British royals are just missing completely at this point. But I know they're all very, very powerful. They're very in control. The only way we can ever defeat them is by pressing little buttons on an iPad attached to a black box and then hoping the television tells us we did it right. This is the Wall Street Journal today. Blinken meets with Xi as U.S. pressures China to end support for Russia. Oh, that'll work. Yes, Xi Jinping is going to see Antony Blinken and be like, oh no, I'll do whatever this guy says. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Chinese leader Xi Jinping on Friday as the U.S. urged Beijing to cut back on his nation's extensive support for Russia's defense industry. Oh yeah, they'll probably back down on that one. The tone of Washington's relations with Beijing has improved markedly since a Chinese balloon drifted over the U.S. in early 2023, prompting American allegations about Chinese espionage. Skipping down, U.S. officials say that China has provided Moscow with optics, microelectronics, drone engines, and other materials that, while not lethal weaponry, have nonetheless strengthened Russia's military industry at a critical stage in the conflict with Ukraine. And they have said that every stage in the conflict with Ukraine has been critical. That adds to the drama they're attempting to build. China has heeded Western calls not to provide arms to Russia, but a brisk trade between the two neighbors in so-called dual-use goods, which have military and non-military applications, has boosted Moscow's efforts to rebuild its military industry, which has been constrained by Western sanctions. Has it? Nearly all reports, even regime reports, suggest that Russia's military capacity, their manufacturing capacity, is far higher than anyone else's. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that U.S. officials were drafting sanctions that would cut off some Chinese banks from the global financial system if Beijing rebuffed its demands. And again, paper tiger. That's not a threat. They made that threat against Russia. They imposed that threat, cutting Russia off from SWIFT, and Russia's currency and economy got stronger. This pattern can only repeat. It is never going to work. And when you know that, you gotta wonder what else is going on here. Chinese officials have repeatedly complained that the U.S. is seeking to hamper its economic development by limiting its access to advanced chips and going after some of its leading technology companies, such as TikTok owner ByteDance, while selling weapons to Taiwan. Overall, the U.S.-China relationship is beginning to stabilize, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said at the start of his meeting Friday with Blinken. But at the same time, the negative factors in the relationship are still increasing and building. China's legitimate development rights have been unreasonably suppressed, and our core interests are facing challenges. The chip thing will obviously be resolved when China simply removes the regime from Taiwan. Taiwan is part of China. It's not a separate country. No matter how many times the television tells us, it's not a separate country. We're not going to go over there and defend them. We're not going to make sure the Chinese can't take Taiwan. We're not going to play any games about the chips and the manufacturing that are there. Donald Trump was bringing all of that back to the United States. That is how our future will go. Doesn't matter if people think it's very, very important that we protect our chips in Taiwan. If they've read so many articles and they have a friend who's an expert or works in the industry, none of those things will matter. There is a reality that is happening. It is playing out. It is already planned and agreed to play out that way. The stage show, the performance we are given by our media and our politicians about how the reality is playing out, none of it matters, which means how we feel about it could not possibly matter any less. We will see people trying to have this argument and play out this argument, and they will call each other patriotic and unpatriotic based on where they stand on our commitment to protect our ally in Taiwan. Except again, it's American policy that Taiwan is part of China. And that's Chinese policy too. It just also happens to conflict with the wants and needs of the global regime, and our uniparty politicians here and our media are happy to support that position. And yes, there are some old school China hawks that just can't get past the beliefs they've held now likely for decades, but there isn't some other way this is going to go. Since before, Putin's very brutal invasion was a glint in the comedic actor Volodymyr Zelensky's eye, we've been talking about China and Taiwan. And since the beginning of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, I've been discussing how China-Taiwan will be a parallel. And both of these situations are parallels to the ones we just discussed in Myanmar and Burkina Faso and Chad and Niger. We'll see what happens with Venezuela and Guyana, but it looks like we might not even have military activity at all, not even a quote-unquote coup in the country to resolve that situation. But with Russia and Ukraine, China and Taiwan, we have major global regime proxies. These are key locations for the regime. We ended up with the whole Israel-Middle East thing being sandwiched between Russia-Ukraine and China-Taiwan. But at some point, we're going to see resolution of the China-Taiwan situation. And we will return to China in just a second. But we have another violation of the Logan Act by Donald Trump again. This is Newsweek from Wednesday. Donald Trump gifting key to White House raises eyebrows. Wait, what? Not only is he not being pursued under the Logan Act for meeting with these foreign officials and discussing American foreign policy with these foreign officials, now he's just going around giving them keys to the White House? How does Donald Trump even have the ability to give away keys to the White House? He's not president anymore. He's a former president, you see? Former President Donald Trump is receiving flack from critics for presenting a high-ranking Japanese official with what seemed like a key to the White House, even though Trump doesn't currently occupy the residence on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Oh, he doesn't occupy the residence. Is that what's happening? Trump hosted former Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso on Tuesday evening at Trump Tower, hours after the ex-president and presumptive Republican presidential nominee exited the courtroom as part of his ongoing hush money criminal trial in Manhattan. So by day, he's extremely indicted, and by night, he is conducting American foreign policy and giving away keys to the White House. The meeting included the pair posing with a key memorialized with an image posted by Trump on his Truth Social platform, smiling alongside the ex-prime minister who left his position in 2009 but remains influential in Japan as vice president of the nation's Liberal Democratic Party. The significance of the key is unknown. Yeah, very, very unknown. The Newsweek article quotes the two men exchanging niceties. Taro Aso, by the way, has a very, very interesting Wikipedia page, and I suggest everyone give it a look. But let's jump down to key reactions. The image of the pair posing with the key has garnered attention online. "Not sure what gives him the right to do this," wrote former NBC Universal executive Mike Sington on X. That guy is one of the most Trump-deranged people online. "Probably Citizen Trump once again pretending to be president." Ah, yeah, that's cute, Mike. You've really analyzed the situation. He's just pretending to be president. That's what he's doing, giving White House keys to foreign leaders, everyone knowing that he's about to be president again. Trump and former Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso pose with a ceremonial key to the White House on Tuesday. That's yesterday Tuesday, not Tuesday from 1-2017 through 1-2021. If he thinks he has the right to do that, what else is he giving away? Wrote some guy on Twitter. Trump is insane. He lives in an alternate universe. This is a photo of him yesterday gifting a key to the White House to the Japanese Prime Minister. He is delusional, wrote another Twitter user that Newsweek decided to quote. Jared Kushner, the ex-president's son-in-law and former White House advisor, wrote in his 2022 memoir, Breaking History, that his father-in-law designed keys for special guests. They were etched with the presidential seal and the words, "Key to the White House," So Donald Trump is giving away keys to the White House with the presidential seal on them, but he's not president. Okay. One of the recipients of the key during Trump's first term was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who visited the U.S. in 2020 during the signing of the Abraham Accords. Netanyahu wasn't the first recipient of the key, Kushner said. When Trump met with Netanyahu, he whipped out his signature gift, an oversized bronze key to the White House in a wooden box carved with the presidential seal, Kushner writes in the memoir. Trump had designed the key himself to give to special guests. "This is the first key I'm giving to anyone," Trump said. "Even when I'm not president anymore, you can walk up to the front gate of the White House and present it, and they will let you in." Amazing. It's all so, so great. Kushner admits that he and fellow White House advisor Avi Berkowitz tried to keep from laughing at the key offering. Well, that's maybe because Donald Trump is hilarious and what they were doing was hilarious. Very nice of Netanyahu to play along. According to an ex post by the Trump campaign, Trump and Aso discussed the enduring importance of the U.S.-Japan alliance to both countries' physical and economic security and to stability in the Indo-Pacific. They also discussed challenges posed by China and North Korea, with Trump praising Japan's increased defense spending. The Trump-Aso meeting came about 2 weeks after President Joe Biden hosted Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida at the White House in an effort to boost both nations' military alliance in response to rising geopolitical tensions. Who would you take if you were going to bet on one of these sides? Would you bet on Trump, Aso, or would you bet on Joe Biden and Fumio Kishida? You don't have to know anything about Fumio Kishida to know that whatever agenda Biden and Kishida are working on together will never be implemented. You know how you know that? Because Donald Trump just took a picture with Taro Aso giving him a key to the White House. That is all the evidence anyone could ever need. Okay, back to China again and back to the Wall Street Journal. This is from Tuesday. U.S. takes aim at Chinese banks aiding Russia war effort. And we touched on this just briefly in the article about Blinken's meeting. The U.S. is drafting sanctions that threaten to cut some Chinese banks off from the global financial system, arming Washington's top envoy with diplomatic leverage that officials hope will stop Beijing's commercial support of Russia's military production, according to people familiar with the matter. Skipping down, referring to Blinken, the Wall Street Journal writes, "This time as he heads to China, officials are counting on the threat of Chinese banks losing access to the dollar and the risk of roiling trade ties with Europe persuading Beijing to change tack. The banks serve as intermediaries for the commercial exports to Russia, handling payments and providing client companies credit for trade transactions. China can't have it both ways," Blinken said. "It can't purport to want to have positive, friendly relations with countries in Europe and at the same time be fueling the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War." I wonder if Blinken was openly weeping when he said that. "It is entirely possible for countries to expect to have friendly relations with other countries who they're not in conflict with, regardless of whether or not those countries express that they feel threatened by a third country who China happens to be doing business with." A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington described the exports as lawful trade and said the U.S. was making groundless accusations. "China's right to conduct normal trade and economic exchanges with Russia and other countries in the world on the basis of equality and mutual benefit should not be interfered with or disrupted," the spokesperson told the journal. "The United States should immediately stop imposing unilateral sanctions on Chinese companies and individuals." And in principle, you have to think that what the Chinese spokesperson is saying rings true. U.S. officials say targeting banks with sanctions is an escalatory option in case the diplomatic overtures fail to persuade Beijing to curb its exports. U.S. officials have ramped up pressure on Beijing in recent weeks in private meetings and calls, warning that Washington is ready to take action against Chinese financial institutions handling trade in such dual-use goods. Officials say they hope the combined Western diplomatic pressure will avert the need to take an action that could break a fragile détente between the two powers. Cutting banks off from access to the dollar, the denomination of most global trade, has much broader implications than normal sanctions targeting individuals and firms, and so are often reserved as a last resort. Such sanctions often force banks into failure, affecting their entire customer and client base, and represent a particular risk for China as the country grapples with growing credit problems. And let's skip down toward the end. China's foreign ministry calls the sanctions against its firms, including for dual-use shipments, economic coercion, unilateralism, and bullying. China will continue to do what is necessary to firmly safeguard the lawful rights and interests of Chinese companies, the ministry's spokesman told reporters in a recent press conference. Washington's European allies have shown even more reticence to apply punitive measures against a major trade partner and financier, sanctioning only a fraction of the scores of firms put on U.S. rosters. Olaf Scholz, Chancellor of Germany, acknowledged China's refusal to sell weapons to Russia during his meetings in Beijing last week. Germany and some other key European allies had been satisfied with that no-arms policy as enough. Now there's an effort to adjust that in part because of the scale of Chinese support, a former senior U.S. national security official said. So some guy. The hope is that we get the Europeans to read China the Riot Act. Never going to happen. Scholz hinted at a change in policy after his meetings, though when pressed by reporters, he declined to elaborate. The question of dual use should not be ignored either, he said. The U.S. believes that Europe's financial and trade ties with China mean it has more diplomatic sway than Washington over Beijing. There is underused leverage by the West, especially given the dollar and euro dominance in the financial system, said Maria Snegovaya, a senior fellow at CSIS and one of the chief authors of its recent report. That could be one promising avenue to deal with the problem. So a woman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a globalist think tank, thinks the dollar and euro are going to be the leverage that can be used by Europe against China. The U.S. has no leverage here. Europe has no leverage here. The fact that these stories are even printed is embarrassing. Maybe they think they're generating anti-China sentiment that they plan to use when the China-Taiwan thing happens. But this is absurd. Each story shows more weakness than the last. So let's stick with the Wall Street Journal, but we're going to bring it back to the good old US of A. This is from yesterday, the headline. Trump allies draw up plans to blunt Fed's independence. This is a long article. I'm not going to go through the entire thing. Donald Trump's allies are quietly drafting proposals that would attempt to erode the Federal Reserve's independence if the former president wins a second term, in the midst of a deepening divide among his advisors over how aggressively to challenge the central bank's authority. Former Trump administration officials and other supporters of the presumptive GOP nominee have in recent months discussed a range of proposals, from incremental policy changes to a long-shot assertion that the president himself should play a role in setting interest rates. A small group of the president's allies, whose work is so secretive that even some prominent former Trump economic aides weren't aware of it, has produced a roughly 10-page document outlining a policy vision for the central bank, according to people familiar with the matter. The group of Trump's allies argues that he should be consulted on interest rate decisions, and the draft document recommends subjecting Fed regulations to White House review and more forcefully using the Treasury Department as a check on the central bank. The group also contends that Trump, if he returns to the White House, would have the authority to oust Jerome Powell as Fed chair before his four-year term ends in 2026, the people familiar with the matter said, though Powell would likely remain on the Fed's board of governors. It couldn't be determined whether Trump is aware of or signed off on the effort, but some people close to the discussions believe the work has received the blessing of the former president. In a statement, Trump advisors Susan Wiles and Chris LaCivita said, "Let us be very specific here. Unless a message is coming directly from President Trump or an authorized member of his campaign team, no aspect of future presidential staffing or policy announcements should be deemed official." And Trump himself just said within the past couple of weeks, "No one speaks for Trump but Trump." Skipping down. Several people who have spoken with Trump about the Fed said he appears to want someone in charge of the institution who will, in effect, treat the president as an ex officio member of the central bank's rate-setting committee. Under such an approach, the chair would regularly seek Trump's views on interest rate policy and then negotiate with the committee to steer policy on the president's behalf. Some of the former president's advisors have discussed requiring that candidates for the Fed chair privately agree to consult informally with Trump on the central bank's decisions, the people familiar with the matter said. Others have made the case that Trump himself could sit on the Fed's board of governors on an acting basis, an option that several people close to the former president described as far-fetched. The article goes on to quote some uniparty right senators so that the Wall Street Journal's readership knows that Trump is very, very bad and probably going to mess up the entire economy. They quote Tom Tillis of North Carolina and Kevin Cramer of North Dakota. They're both very concerned that the Fed remains independent. And why do they want that? Why do they want the central bankers deciding on interest rates? They're supposed to keep inflation low and employment high, and they don't accomplish either task. They also unduly influence politics. And then there's that whole thing about the Federal Reserve being an entity of the central banks, and of course the IRS being the collection arm of the Federal Reserve, and not actually a part of the United States government. They are not in any way part of the United States. It is just our special central bank operating for the benefit of the global regime and the global central bankers. And the dynamic presented here is an interesting one. They're suggesting that the president shouldn't have any control over this because the president would make political decisions. But the Fed, as an independent entity, has already made political decisions. That is one of the tools they use to keep the duly elected American president under control. The central banks exercise sanctions in the name of the United States to manipulate and control other countries. Well, they can't have the United States impose sanctions on the United States, so instead they just manipulate monetary policy in order to serve their political needs, and they can use that and make threats on a sitting president. Why would we want this outside foreign entity to hold sway over a legitimately duly elected American president? That is a crazy situation. All of this caused deranged communist Jonathan Chait over at New York Magazine to have one of his traditional meltdowns. The headline on his article this morning, "Trump's Second Term Plan Includes Federal Reserve Coup. The next Trump administration will be far more chaotic." And this discusses Jerome Powell. He writes, "Despite having chosen Powell for the position, Trump turned against him, as he did many of his appointees, because Powell did not treat Trump's immediate political needs with sufficient, which to Trump means absolute, attention. Trump repeatedly demanded interest rate cuts that Powell did not supply. His goal is to make the next occupant of the position, which could either be Powell or somebody else, more pliant. The danger of such an arrangement would be compounded by the fact that Trump is contemplating an inflationary agenda during a second term. His major domestic policies include a broad-based tariff, which would raise the price of goods, another upper-class tax cut, and another middle-class tax cut to wash away the nasty political aftertaste of giving the rich a tax cut." Now, if you're not a liar, you would just say he's giving everyone a tax cut because people below the middle class don't even pay taxes. And hopefully, as the country begins to get more intelligent, nobody will be paying taxes, at least not to the federal government. All these prospective moves would put more pressure on the Fed to tamp down inflation than existed during Trump's first term, when inflation was continuing the low trajectory that had remained in place since the Clinton era. The Fed's autonomy would have greater importance, which explains why Trump's advisors are especially determined to curtail it. And of course, the broader context is that a prospective second Trump administration will be designed to break through the guardrails that held him back the first time. Unlike Republican traditionalists and many voters, Trump considers his first term a failure and blames the disloyalty of his appointees. So we are told by our mainstream propaganda media that Donald Trump is going to seize additional, somehow undue control over the Federal Reserve, which they argue, for some reason, should be independent. But as with so many other things, is this something Trump is going to do in the future, or is this something Trump already put in place in the past? And so let's turn to Badlands' own Joe Lang. This is on badlands.substack.com. The article is called Master and Commander, and he talks about Donald Trump and the Federal Reserve, arguing that Donald Trump brought the Fed back in control of the Treasury during his first term. How did Trump take control of the Federal Reserve away from the Rothschilds? This is a section about halfway down the piece. It started when he was first elected. The president is the one who appoints the Board of Governors to the Federal Reserve. There are seven total governors on the board, and when Trump was elected, there were already two vacancies that Obama had left for Hillary Clinton, his presumed successor, to fill. And there were all those federal court vacancies as well. Incredible. They never thought she would lose, Joe Lang reminds us. We then got three more resignations, including some that look like they may have been forced by Trump himself, such as Vice Chairman Stanley Fischer, who stepped down in 2017, according to Benzinga. The Federal Reserve will lose an influential centrist with the resignation of Vice Chairman Stanley Fischer, according to a letter sent Wednesday to President Donald Trump. Fischer will retire from the Board of Governors by October 13th for personal reasons, leaving his leadership post 1 year early and cutting his general term with the Fed 2 years short. So two vacancies and three early resignations allowed Trump to appoint five of the seven governors to the board of the Federal Reserve during his tenure. Then Trump pulled a genius move. He appointed Jerome Powell, who was already on the Board of Governors, to the position of chairman, replacing Janet Yellen, who was Obama's appointment. That freed up another vacant position on the Board of Governors, which gave him six out of seven total positions and near full control of the Federal Reserve. Lang goes on, and I encourage you to read that, jumping down to the next section. Trump rolls the Fed into the Treasury. This was a massive story back in March 2020, right before Trump's presumed imminent re-election, but it wasn't talked about much in the media, aside from some of the financial media, and almost nobody knows about it. Lang writes, "I believe Trump used the plandemic the enemy launched on the world as the excuse he needed to roll the Federal Reserve into the U.S. Treasury, which the president controls as part of the executive branch." According to Bloomberg, the Fed will finance a special purpose vehicle for each acronym to conduct these operations. The Treasury, using the Exchange Stabilization Fund, will make an equity investment in each SPV and be in a first loss position. What does this mean? In essence, the Treasury, not the Fed, is buying all these securities and backstopping of loans. The Fed is acting as banker and providing financing. The Fed hired BlackRock Incorporated to purchase these securities and handle the administration of the SPVs on behalf of the owner, the Treasury. And I'm going to have to spend some more time digging on that aspect. That is very interesting. It's one of those sentences that you can read and not think much about it, and then in the future read it and be like, oh, wow, that is really, really interesting. BlackRock was being used to facilitate this? In other words, the federal government is nationalizing large swaths of the financial markets. The Fed is providing the money to do it. BlackRock will be doing the trades. This scheme essentially merges the Fed and the Treasury into one organization, so meet your new Fed chairman, Donald J. Trump. That's Bloomberg writing that. Back to Joe Lang. Trump assumed full control of the Federal Reserve, the most powerful central bank in the world. The Exchange Stabilization Fund was a fund set up way back in 1934 that most people didn't know existed. It was completely controlled by the Treasury and the President, exempt from congressional approval. It was originally set up as a means of intervening in currency markets to benefit the U.S. economy, but now has since become a loan program for other countries' central banks when they are in distress. Consider it a permanent bailout option for global central banks. Instead of bailing out central banks, Trump used this fund to bail out American companies that were struggling to survive during the pandemic and forced the Federal Reserve to finance it all. The Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury are now working for the American people, not the central banks. With the Federal Reserve note, the U.S. dollar, being the world's reserve currency, and with currencies forced to purchase oil in dollars, the Rothschilds and their global debt system is now hanging on the edge of a cliff. They no longer control the Fed or the dollar. Now, again, this piece is nearly a year old, so things have changed since then. I encourage everybody to go check out this piece and spend some time on it. Master and Commander by Joe Lang, L-A-N-G-E. But think about that. We are being told that Donald Trump in the future is going to make the Fed less independent. Jonathan Chait is having a meltdown over this. But the truth is, this happened 4 years ago. It's incredible, isn't it? I hope you all have a great weekend. I will be back on Monday at the same reasonable time on the same reasonable podcast network. I don't have a network. Masks and lockdowns don't work. They lied to you about a pandemic. And Joe Biden will never be president.
In my mind, that's the end game.
If you're listening to this episode for free, you can support me and support the show and the work I do by signing up for a paid subscription at imyourmoderator.substack.com. You can do so for as low as $50 a year or $5 a month. Comes out to under a quarter per episode, and you'll blast right through the paywall for all of the writing. The merch store is www.cancelcouture.com, and you can find everything else by heading to Linktree, linktree.com/imyourmoderator. And I'll see you soon, out on the range.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
In my mind, that's the end game.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to follow what I'm reading and thinking throughout the day, you can do that by downloading the Telegram Messenger app and going to t.me/I'm your moderator. On social media, you can follow me on Truth Social, Getter, and Gab at I'm Your Moderator. I also have channels on Rumble and BitChute. If you'd like to follow the writing, you can find me at I'mYourModerator.substack.com. The merch site is CancelCouture.com or go direct shop.spreadshirt.com/cancel-couture. If you'd like to support the podcast financially, the best place to do that is Ko-Fi. Go to ko-fi.com/I'mYourModerator. And all of these details will appear in the show notes with each episode. I'll see you soon, down on the range.
It's hell!